This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Protests in Cuba spilling over into Boston. The music there and sound of a protest in Copley Square overnight, where activists rallied to support the thousands taking to the streets 1,500 miles away in Cuba. Massachusetts is home to a small but mighty Cuban population, the 13th largest in the country. And many stand in solidarity as family members and loved ones protest the lack of food and medical supplies on the island. WBUR's Simone Rios was at Copley Square and joins us now. Simone, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana.
So, Simone, tell us what you heard from people at the protest.
So just to set the scene, there were a few dozen people across from Boston's Central Library. And there seemed to be a mix of perspectives, amid the Cuban flags and music that we heard. There was one guy with a Don't Tread on Me flag, which is used by the Tea Party movement. And another had a sign calling for an end to the U.S. embargo against Cuba, coming from a left position. I spoke to one of the organizers, Jordan Villalon. He's a grad student at La Salle University in Newton. He was born in Havana and raised in Miami.
No more fear. We have nothing else to lose at this current.
No tenemos miedo.
No tenemos miedo. We're not scared. We have been at this for 60 years. We have had the same problem for 60 plus years. And I think the goal is to end dictatorship and begin something new.
Another one of the organizers was Sam Bello. She's a Cuban-American and studies at a local college.
It doesn't matter how many decades I think people have been either here or wherever in the diaspora. I think most Cubans and Cuban-Americans can relate to what that is. It's in our everyday lives. It's in hearts. It's our trauma.
It's hard to say whether these kind of sentiments are consistent with what's happening on the island, Tiziana, but I think we can say that Cubans everywhere in the world are feeling this moment.
Simone, what do we know about the conditions that led to the protests in Cuba and here?
Cuba has had a very difficult time in recent years. I think regardless of your politics, people can agree that Cuba is suffering both economically and now because of the pandemic. The island with more doctors per capita than almost anywhere on Earth, the country that's developing its own COVID vaccines, but which can't secure basic medications or supplies like syringes. It's a tremendous irony. Here's what Jordan Villalon said he's hearing about the situation down there.
There's just no food. There's no water. If there was money, there would be nothing to buy. And it's hard to fathom. It sounds like an exaggeration. But before we get that far down the pipeline, we have to understand that right now what we're fighting for is basic human rights.
So politics come into play here when you ask, who's to blame for this situation? Is it the Cuban government or is it the six-decade U.S. embargo against Cuba?
Simone, you've been there. You've reported on the Cuban community here. Just how significant do you think it is to see such open dissent?
Yeah. So I was there in 2006. It was when Fidel Castro was stepping down and handing power over to his brother. So it might not have been a typical time on the island. But one of the things that stuck with me the most was there's many good things to say about Cuba, but what a closed society it was, a police state with really no room for freedom of expression. So, you know, I try to discuss politics with people in the street, and I quickly realized that they wouldn't say anything critical of the government in public and even hush their voices inside their homes. So to see people from what we're seeing here in the States taking to the streets in Cuba and calling for change in such a public way, you know, things we take for granted here in the U.S., that seems like a very big deal in Cuba. I spoke to Miren Uriarte. She's a former UMass Boston professor, born in Cuba, came to the U.S. a year after the 1959 revolution. She says she wants to see an end to the U.S. embargo against Cuba, which, of course, were hardened by the Trump administration, and which the Cuban government blames this uprising on. The question on the island, Uriarte says, is how the government will respond to these protests.
We need to see how the Cuban government approaches this, what kind of dialogue it establishes with the younger generation and with the people that are demonstrating, and what the outcome of that is.
Well, Simone, we will be watching for that outcome with you. WBUR reporter Simone Rios, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
So listening into that report is Congressman Jim McGovern. He's just off a tour of three local hunger sites today. The congressman represents Massachusetts' 2nd District and chairs the House Rules Committee. He's also been active in U.S. policy toward Cuba throughout his time in public service. Congressman McGovern, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Happy to be with you.
I want to start with Cuba here. Cuba policy is important to you. You were there when President Obama traveled to Cuba the first time a sitting president had been to the island in nearly 90 years. So with all of that in mind, what is your reaction to what you've heard and are hearing from Cuban Americans in Massachusetts?
Well, first of all, all of our hearts are with the Cuban people. I strongly believe in the right for people to engage in peaceful and legitimate protest. I've called upon the Cuban government to respect the rights of their people to protest. Now, having said all of that, I think that one simple question should anchor U.S. policy on Cuba, and that is, how can we improve the lives of the people of Cuba? I think we have to recognize that U.S. policy for many decades has been focused on trying to overthrow the government and to economically starve the people. I mean, for anybody to not acknowledge that the U.S. embargo has had a major negative impact on the lives of average Cubans, anyone who says that it hasn't is not dealing with reality. One of the ways we can help Cuban people is we can lift the embargo. And Biden can reverse Trump's added restrictions that he put into place when he was president, to make it easier for people to get food, syringes, other supplies, and to make it easier for people to travel to Cuba.
So with that in mind, the Cuban government is blaming these protests on the U.S., as well as the lack of supplies. President Miguel Diaz-Canel broke into national television to blame the U.S. for restricting exports, access and funds, tying those policies directly to the supply shortages. I hear you. I hear that. Any concern that putting the attention right now in the Biden administration, the embargoes, et cetera, gives cover to Miguel Diaz-Canel and policy decisions in Cuba?
Look, what I'm advocating is not about helping the Cuban government. It's about helping the Cuban people. President Trump put restrictions in place that do not even allow Cuban families the ability to send appropriate amounts of remittances back to their relatives in Cuba. Again, making it more difficult for average Cubans to be able to have a decent life. We should do what is right by the Cuban people. It should have nothing to do with what the Cuban government wants or doesn't want. People are protesting. They have legitimate reason to protest. Again, a poor response to the COVID pandemic, food shortages. People are hungry. People's civil liberties have been trampled on. So those are legitimate reasons for people to be upset. Any of us would protest that. But again, we have to recognize that U.S. policy has only contributed to making the lives of average Cubans more miserable. Not just recently, it's gone on for decades. And look, the Cuban government, the hardliners have been all too willing to blame us for everything. We give them fodder. Advocating military action against Cuba.
So let me break in here on that. One more question on this, then I want to cover some hunger stuff with you, too. Yes. But to that point, President Diaz-Canel is urging his supporters to take to the streets and physically confront protesters, deploying police and military against them. NPR estimates 148 people have been arrested, detained, or disappeared since Sunday. What should the U.S. response to that part be?
The U.S. response should be to engage the Cuban government, to tell them to stop. But since we don't have an ambassador in Cuba, I mean, we don't even have the diplomatic channels to be able to communicate in a responsible and mature way. And the other thing is we should do what is right by the Cuban people. I mean, let us help get humanitarian aid to the island. Let us lift the Trump restrictions. Let us go back to the Obama policies, quite frankly, of engagement. I condemn any crackdown on legitimate protest. I mean, we all do. But let's not use the Cuban government as an excuse to not help the Cuban people. And again, those people who right now are calling for military action, we're calling for further restrictions that will only hurt the average Cuban even more. I think that's cruel. We ought to recognize that our Cold War policies for the last several decades have been a miserable failure. We ought to have a different approach to Cuba. We ought to normalize relations. We ought to engage the country so we actually can talk to them face-to-face on issues like human rights. But we ought to focus on how do we help the Cuban people.
All right. Thank you for that. I'm going to turn our attention now here home, where we're also, I want to talk about hunger. As I said, you spent the day at three federally funded meal sites in Spencer and Worcester with Project Bread, which is a nonprofit hunger organization. We have talked with you a lot about hunger, including recently. So why a tour today in the middle of July?
Well, because hunger amongst children actually gets worse during the summertime when school is out and and sometimes, history is any indication, kids go without and we see food insecurity rise. So we have these federally funded summer meals programs. We want to highlight them. We want more people to take advantage of them. I'm also doing this because I am pushing the Biden administration to do a White House conference on food, nutrition, health, and hunger. We need to solve this problem. And, you know, summer meals is part of it. But it's only a part of it. We need to look at everything. And not just nutrition programs. We need to look at decent wages for jobs, housing. We need to look at the medical connections to nutrition. I mean, a whole thing. We need a holistic view here. And so, today I was visiting programs, quite frankly, that a lot of parents rely on to help feed their kids when school is out. And so, I talked to a lot of the parents and the kids. They're grateful for these programs. We got to support them. We made rules more flexible during the pandemic. We got to keep that flexibility in place so that more people can take advantage of them. And so it was a good visit.
Let's pick that up. So the USDA did just extend some free meal programs for kids to September. There are a lot of federal pandemic measures that affect family hunger that will expire. Last week, we had Assistant Speaker Catherine Clark on. She said she wanted to make several pandemic measures focused on kids permanent. Are you looking for the same thing on hunger measures that have resulted from the pandemic? Do you want permanent? You want them made permanent?
I do. I really do. Food is not a luxury. It's a necessity. And whether we're talking about our children or our senior citizens or anybody in between, we got to make sure that people have enough to eat. And when it comes to kids, we ought to be thinking about, providing everybody in school a free breakfast and lunch. You know, if you're hungry in school, you can't learn. And that breakfast or lunch is every bit as important to that child's ability to learn as a textbook or a laptop. We need to be thinking out of the box. And, waivers are important, but we ought to be able to, we ought to make these things permanent, whether it's a child tax credit, whether it's the flexibility in the meals program, whatever, to be able to pick up a meal at whatever site is convenient for you, whatever. But we got to do better on this, and that's why I want this White House conference, because we need to connect the dots. We need a holistic approach. Again, it's not just about our children, although our children are 100% of our future, and they're the most important things in the world to us. But we got to solve this problem throughout this country. We should be ashamed that close to 40 million people are hungry.
So we're having a little bit of sound challenge. I know you're on the move. Last question before we let you go. As you talk, I can hear critics in my head saying, hey, the government can't be our long-term solution to feeding people. So what do you say to that counter response? And what's the package of jobs, education, other forms of prosperity that you want in place to address hunger as well?
Well, one is I want good jobs to pay good wages. When people say to me, oh, the government can't solve all the problems, but yet those same people are content with providing SNAP benefits to subsidize low wages by big corporations. I mean, look, we need to make sure that work pays in this country. We need to make sure that people have access to child care. We need to make sure that people can afford their medical care. All those things are incredibly important. So, you know, if you want to put these programs out of business, if you want to put food banks out of business, we can do that if we pay a living wage with good benefits. And that ought to be our focus.
All right, that is Congressman Jim McGovern, who represents Massachusetts' 2nd District, also chairs the House Rules Committee. Chairman McGovern, thanks for joining us.
All the best.
Right now, there are 7, that's right, 7 offshore wind turbines operating in the United States. But that's going to change soon, especially for folks on and around Martha's Vineyard, where 62 turbines will be built as part of Vineyard Wind, the first commercial-sized offshore wind project in the country. That project receives approval from the Biden administration back in May. So it's coming, and we wanted to take some time to talk about this brand new industry, what it means for Massachusetts, what it means for the country. Here to help us do that is New Hampshire Public Radio's climate, energy, and environment reporter and co-host of NHPR's Windfall podcast, Annie Ropick. Annie, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So as any good Massachusetts resident knows, Annie, the seacoast of New Hampshire is a relatively small area compared to neighboring Maine or Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. But you picked wind. Why this NHPR podcast now? Is it about the potential of the industry or what a big deal this is going to be?
Yeah, it's about both. I mean, this really is a moment for the offshore wind industry in the U.S., kind of the moment when the stars have finally aligned and this industry is ready to launch, especially on the East Coast, as you mentioned, and, you know, maybe even in states like New Hampshire with our little coastline up in the Gulf of Maine, all the way down, you know, Virginia, the Mid-Atlantic, and soon potentially off the California coast, the Gulf Coast. You know, the Biden administration is really centering offshore wind in their climate and energy policies as a huge potential source of renewable energy. And so we wanted to look in this moment at what that means for coastal states, for racial equity, like you mentioned, sort of economic equality in this country, and just like what it looks like when an industry is born out of nothing in a country like this, you know, in the era of climate change.
All right. And I want to hear some of what you learned. But Annie Ropick, I want to take just a second to address your co-host, Sam Evans-Brown. We take our journalistic responsibility seriously. I know you do, too. Sam Evans-Brown co-hosted Windfall, but has since left NHPR to work as a clean energy advocate, specifically in support of offshore wind. So in your reporting, how did you deal with his departure editorially to ensure that the reporting didn't contain any biases?
Yeah, we appreciate the chance to address this. So the reason that I am involved in this project is because really just at the very end of the reporting and writing and editing process, this opportunity came up for Sam, who was the founding host of Outside In, which is the podcast that is leading this Windfall series. And like you said, Sam is already now being a clean energy advocate, and that purview includes offshore wind in this region for sure. So we brought me in as an extra set of eyes on the show, an extra editor and a co-host to make sure that the thing was airtight, you know, that there was no bias creeping in. We've had a huge team editing this, and we hired an outside fact checker as well, and just wanted to bring an extra set of journalistic eyes to it. We also made sure that Sam's new job didn't overlap at all with his work on the show, and, you know, he hasn't had editorial input since he began the new job. And, you know, we think it's an important enough topic to not just scrap the show over something like this, and we want people to hear it and decide for themselves.
All right. So in your learning, we often hear offshore wind talked about as a big part of an environmentally friendly future. Why is that? Is it as simple as wind is renewable, or is there more to it?
So it's renewable at huge scale, I think, is the key. You know, if you compare the sort of amount of effort and the space and the money that it takes to build, you know, a solar farm that can produce the same amount of power as wind, just for example, you're getting a lot more bang for your buck with a wind farm. You can produce the same amount of power on the order of like a nuclear power plant, or the amount of wind that's in the pipeline for the East Coast right now, another way of looking at this, is enough to power 2 New York cities. So when you think about it on those scales, that's really a game changer for the renewable energy industry, which until now has been, you know, a percent here and there. And wind really has the potential to take a huge chunk out of the carbon emissions that we need to reduce in order to address climate change. And it could take a chunk out of it really quickly.
So let's talk about this huge scale thing. I know we only have a handful of turbines in the U.S. In Europe, for example, there are thousands. How far behind is the country compared to the rest of the world?
We're completely behind. Like you said, only 7 turbines. 5 of those are in Rhode Island, 2 are in Virginia, and they're all in state waters. So we're at the beginning of the full scale, the utility scale industry here in the States. And a lot of that is down to the sort of false start that was the Cape Wind project that a lot of your listeners are probably familiar with, which was also off of Cape Cod and sort of took 16 years to die a slow death and really taught the government, you know, the wind industry a lot of lessons about how not to do this. And we're seeing those applied to now projects like Vineyard Wind that's really moving forward quickly. And like I said, there are, in, you know, every day more projects in the pipeline behind it waiting for approval, waiting to be built. And the Biden administration wants to see pretty much the same amount of wind as there is everywhere else in the world in U.S. waters by 2030.
So in our last minute or so, you talked about the lessons of Cape Wind. Obviously, the general position has changed because Vineyard Wind is happening, but there is still opposition. In Maine, for example, they recently banned offshore wind projects from state waters to help protect the commercial fishing industry. So where is the pushback today to wind, and what do you expect from that?
Yeah, the pushback from the fishing industry is huge, and that is still an ongoing debate, like you mentioned, in Maine and in states like New Hampshire, down to Vineyard Wind in Massachusetts. We spent a whole episode looking at the effect on the squid fishery in Rhode Island, where Vineyard Wind is just about as close to Rhode Island as it is to Massachusetts. It's a pretty unsolved question. In Europe, a lot of those projects just buy out the fishing industries that will be affected and don't allow fishing where the projects are built. So it's a little untested. There hasn't actually been as much research as you'd think on what wind turbines actually mean for fisheries, and the devil is in the details with how they're built, how the fishing works in the same place. So, you know, we're going to have to find out as the industry moves forward, and it's definitely something we're going to hear a lot about in the Northeast.
All right, Annie Ropeek, NHPR climate, energy, and environment reporter and co-host of the Windfall podcast. It was a fascinating podcast, Annie. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
So I want to bring in an additional voice now to help us figure out what this all means for the Commonwealth specifically. We have Elizabeth Turnbull-Henry, president of the Environmental League of Massachusetts. Elizabeth, I know you're on vacation in a remote location and we might have some lag, but I appreciate you taking time out for us. Welcome.
Hi, Tiziana. Thank you for having me.
All right, so we know Vineyard Wind is making its way forward. It got approval from the Biden administration in May. 62 turbines, first commercial scale project in the U.S. With that in mind, kind of size the shark for us, if you will. How big a deal is Vineyard Wind for Massachusetts and the country?
I can't really overstate how big a deal it is, to be honest. It is the first utility scale offshore wind project. All eyes are on it. Once it's up and running, it will power about 400,000 homes in the Commonwealth, which is about 1 in 6. So it's a really big deal, and it sets a big precedent. I should say that quick on its heels is the Mayflower Wind Project, and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts has recently released a RFP or a solicitation for the third offshore wind project, which is going to be double the size of Vineyard Wind.
All right. You heard me ask Annie Ropeek about the commercial fishing industry. You know, Maine did this ban of offshore wind projects from state waters to help mitigate those sort of effects. And that was with a governor who is actually pro offshore wind. How is Massachusetts thinking about other ocean users, including commercial fishing?
It's a good question and a really important one. You know, the League of Massachusetts and the New England for Offshore Wind Coalition, which we lead, believe strongly that responsibly developed offshore wind can coexist with the many other ocean uses that we value. But Annie is right that the devil is in the details, and having a robust stakeholder process is fundamental to the responsible build out of this industry.
And how does that work?
Well, I think starting from the very beginning, you know, the offshore wind development process takes many years, starting with the Bureau of Oceans and Energy Management carving out lease areas, which is a stakeholder intensive process, and then convening community members and other stakeholder groups, fisheries associations, to understand how those areas are being used.
So, Elizabeth,
to be a lot of conversation. Go ahead.
Yeah, we have a little bit of a lag again. Sorry about that. You know, I'm thinking about this 62 number turbines. There has to be an environmental impact to building that. These massive structures in an ecosystem. In its approval, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, acknowledges that there's a chance the project could harm marine life. Talk about the trade-offs.
Well, you know, all energy sources, there is no energy source that is without impact. And that calls upon all of us to be conservative with how we use energy, to be thoughtful and efficient, and value energy efficiency. That said, I think utility scale offshore wind, particularly outside of state waters in the federal waters that are further from our coasts, are less likely to interfere with avian flyways, have less marine and fisheries traffic, and can be and construction can be managed in a way to allow for critically endangered species, for example, like the North Atlantic right whale, to pass through during their seasonal migration without interference. So I'm not trying to pretend that there are no impacts, but I do think that particularly relative to almost any other renewable energy resource, and particularly compared to fossil fuels, there's a lot to like about offshore wind.
So let's talk about a potential different impact. There are those saying that this is a new industry and a big one, and as such could actually be used as a way to address the racial wealth gap. I know the Environmental League recently hosted a Zoom event in May connecting 4 offshore wind developers with advocates and business organizations pushing the industry to do that. Where do you see that potential, and what requirements should be in place for future projects to help bring it to fruition?
It's a great question. The Environmental League and our many advocacy partners have been calling for economic inclusion and environmental justice to be key considerations in the evaluation of offshore wind bids. And that's because, as Annie mentioned, offshore wind is projected to be the workhorse of New England's clean energy transition. Although estimates vary, we may see across the 6 New England states the demand for upwards of 50 gigawatts of offshore wind, which represents about $100 billion in direct capital investment across the 6 New England states over the next couple of decades. Less than 10% of the offshore wind that New England needs has been procured, and construction has barely begun. So imagine that nearly everyone who will be hired in the offshore wind industry has not been hired yet. And so I think the time is right to ask the question of who gets these jobs, who gets these contracts and subcontracts. And it is my view that offshore wind will be one of the single largest sources of economic development, of economic activity in New England over the next generation. And so ELM is focused on making changes to the state's procurement policy for offshore wind. We're not looking for quotas or targets per se, but we would like the state to put sufficient weight on economic inclusion and environmental justice in the solicitation process, essentially putting enough points so that developers pay attention, so that they compete on this dimension. You can imagine how powerful it would be if developers and the private sector brought all of their creativity and expertise and resource and truly competed on the basis of economic inclusion.
All right. That is Elizabeth Turnbull Henry, president of the Environmental League of Massachusetts. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us. I'm going to get a little personal for this next conversation. I am broadcasting from home today, which is the pandemic normal. But on Monday, I broadcast from the station for the first time in about 15 months. And I got to tell you, it felt pretty incredible. I was really happy, especially to be with our colleagues at WBUR in Studio 3. But on the drive in Monday morning, I admit that I got to reflecting a little bit about all the ways that my life, my work, the way I interact with my family, my health, you name it, had changed during the pandemic. And I wondered what I wouldn't be able to hold on to going back into the office. That's little things and big things. Everything from could I keep up exercising to would I be ornery and short-tempered with my family when I got home at night. The truth is that I actually felt thrilled and energized at the end of the day. I was excited to reconnect with my family when I got home. And I recognize that that is all privileged stuff. A lot of people, including, for example, most of engineers here at WBUR, never got to go home. And I kept my job. I get all of that. But there are real questions that everyone has about who we have become during the pandemic, how we've adjusted, and what we do and don't want to keep about those changes now that we're finding our collective way back out into the world. And we invite you to talk about that with us now. That's the conversation. What's on your mind about it? What changes, big or small, have you made during the pandemic because of the pandemic? Maybe you're eating out less. Maybe you're maintaining family game nights. Maybe you've been less connected or more connected with other people. Maybe you've ended or started a relationship. What do you want to keep? What do you want to lose? What are you worried about? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pull up a chair and join this conversation. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. So with us to have this conversation, Bethany Van Delft, the host of The 10 News and Artisanal Comedy and co-host of Parental Logic on Nova PBS, and Beth Tytel, a features reporter with the Boston Globe. Bethany, Beth, good to have you both back. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Thank you for having us.
So I felt a little funny telling everybody my story there, Bethany, but I wonder, are you thinking about the same things? Are you reflecting on this stuff too?
Absolutely. I actually just had my first weekend live in person indoors comedy show, 5 shows. So it was really interesting. I'm listening to you talk about getting back to the studio and all the little details that you don't think about, like just getting a lift to the venue. Or that process of saying hello to every single person on the way in before you get a little quiet in the green room to, you know, prepare for your set. Getting a lift after, like I forgot the rideshare rush at the end of a show. So all of those things that I completely forgot about doing Zoom shows, you know, putting on half a face of makeup and half of an outfit and saying goodnight to my kids and then running in the bedroom and locking the door. But I can come right back out actually and catch them in time before the lights go out and their story's over to snuggle with them one last time. Those kind of things I'm thinking about. I'm happy to get back to it. I'm happy to be back in person. But I really do think I'm going to miss being on top of each other all the time. Just the expectation that everyone in my family is always going to be right there.
Beth Tytel, you know, you write about this. You have been sort of the observer of how we absorb pandemic life for 15 months now. I guess I'm imagining as you're listening to me, you're listening to Bethany, you're thinking, I'm not surprised to hear this.
Yeah, you're right. I was actually listening to both of you thinking about, oh, I haven't been back to the Globe newsroom yet. But, you know, one thing a lot of people like that's very convenient is being able to do laundry during the middle of the day. So I'm thinking that maybe the Globe and maybe other companies might want to, you have the lunchroom, but then there's also like a laundromat on site. I think that would actually take some of the pressure off.
As long as none of my colleagues leave their underwear in the dryer.
Right. You have the old stuff. But Kiziana, you're so right. I mean, I have been talking to people for 15 months now about it all. And people are really hesitant to go back to the office. It's one thing that I've been struck by is a lot of companies are going hybrid. But then there's the question of, do we all take the same day back at home? You know, everyone has to be home the same day, because otherwise you can end up in a situation where you're not, the companies aren't really achieving what they want. But then that kind of gets in a situation where a lot of what people enjoy about going to the office, in addition to the work, if you like your work, is seeing people. But now you're going to have to plan, like, are you going to be in on Tuesday? No, I can't do Tuesday. I have a thing. How about Wednesday? I'd be like trying to make plans, you know, to get together with a friend to take a walk or something. I think this is just changing everything.
I want to go ahead and get to the phones. We'll go back and forth between the two of you and the phones throughout this. 1-800-423-8255. What about you that's changed? Are you thinking about as we find our way back out into the world? We've got Alicia on the line in Nashua, New Hampshire. Alicia, go ahead.
Hi. Well, I actually work in a laboratory. So for most of the pandemic, I was actually in the lab where a majority of my coworkers were working from home. And I got to have this flexible hybrid where there are certain days that I could work from home. And now that, you know, things are better, a lot of us are all vaccinated, a majority of my older colleagues actually want to get back into the office, whereas I feel like some of the younger generation are like, no, we've proven we can do hybrid. Why aren't we allowed to do this? Because we have all of our different routines now that we've set up. So it's kind of hard, that discussion.
And Alicia, I do want to ask you before we let you go, as people start to come back, does it feel weird to you, uncomfortable or exciting to have colleagues literally physically back in your space when you've been used to being there when others weren't?
I think like where I didn't have anyone around really other than a few of my colleagues who worked in the lab with me, we set up our safe spaces. So having all these new people coming around, I think, yeah, it's really jarring to kind of go through those changes. We're actually, I spoke to a lot of my other colleagues in the lab, and we had discussed if anyone else comes in, they have to still wear a mask, even though we're all vaccinated, because we're just not there yet. Just because we're, you know, thinking we're past the trauma, we're all dealing with our own traumas in our own way.
Alicia, thanks for that. And Bethany, so much in what Alicia just said, both from the generational differences and how people are valuing being in the workplace now to the collective trauma that may or may not be in line with the science on this. So just first reactions to what we just heard from Alicia.
Bethany. Me?
Bethany. Yeah,
oh,
Bethany.
Hi.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. There really is this kind of two camps right now. I've noticed just this past weekend, there's the group of people that are like, it's over, that's it. They're not wearing masks and they're, you know, they're just, it really feels like it's pre-pandemic. And then there was another group of people, which I didn't really see this group until the late show on Saturday night, but another group of people that are still cautious. They're still wearing their masks, even though you don't have to. I had my mask on the entire time I was indoors, except for when I was on stage. And I felt kind of foolish, like maybe I'm clinging to this trauma or something rather and calling it being cautious. But like I said, I did see people the late show on Saturday also wearing their masks and enjoying a show, figuring out what feels safe to them or what they're comfortable with as first steps in this reentry process. So I don't know. I am so interested to see how it all pans out, to see if maybe people do go back to putting their masks on as variants circulate, or I don't know, maybe I'll take my mask off for good, or maybe this is just going to be a part of my face for the rest of the time. I don't really know.
So I got to turn to Beth Tytel on this, because Beth, of course, you wrote this piece about the chin mask, right? Which was a different thing 6 or 12 months ago when people were angry about those wearing their masks down on their chins because if it's not over your nose, it doesn't protect you, to now sort of representing the mask limbo and the transition in which we're living.
Right. I was thinking that we're really in this liminal space right now. We're sort of in between. I mean, for some people, as Bethany was just saying, it's like the pandemic is over. For others, it remains a very real and present crisis and they're afraid. So that I noticed that it just seems like more than ever, the hot look for summer is the mask underneath your chin. It's like kind of part beard, part fanny pack. And people used to get so mad at people wearing their masks inappropriately, just underneath their nose, which was like the craziest way ever. But this isn't that. This mask says sort of, I'm here to serve. It's like the Tom Hanks of masks. It's not trying to offend anybody, but people wearing it didn't even, after a while, it just sort of becomes part of their summer look, which seems kind of sad. I was thinking that in the future, nobody would even, that would just become a style unto itself. And nobody would even remember that there was a time that it was used to halt disease transmission.
Okay.
But I think it's sort of a physical and facial embodiment of where we are.
I have to take a second to give a bow to the phrase Tom Hanks of masks. That is never going to leave me now. All right. I want to go back to the phones here. 1-800-423-8255, where we have Stephanie, not Bethany, Stephanie in Tyvertown, Rhode Island. Stephanie, go ahead.
Hi. So I'm a midwife and I work throughout the whole pandemic and still continue. And I commute from Rhode Island to Boston. And during the pandemic, I really enjoyed the little traffic there was heading in. But now I'm starting to really not like the traffic. But I was saying, just reflecting on one of the things that my husband and I, I'm glad we did early on was childcare. We were hesitant and we had friends with toddlers the same age as my son that were hesitant to put their kids in childcare just yet, even though some places were open. So we did it, and we needed to socialize him because he's an only child, and I'm glad we did. He's gotten some socialization, and now I'm finding that some friends are having difficulty getting into childcare places as some still remain closed or have certain limits. So that's one of the things I'm glad we kind of did early on, even though we were worried, but we were both vaccinated and just cautious sending him in. So.
Thanks for bringing it up, Stephanie. And Bethany, as I come back to you, I'm thinking about just the practicalities of what Stephanie's talking about and also how it relates to things like concerns over a she session where women, because of childcare needs, for example, but not that's not the only one, sometimes elder care needs, other household needs, have just not had the support to be able to work the way they needed to, lost jobs, taken a step back. There is a lot to sort out for us, you know, I'm talking about the stuff I'm choosing. There's a lot we can't choose that we have got to sort out in order to come back into the world collectively and in a healthy way too, Bethany.
Yeah, I mean, it really, everyone is having, in the beginning, everything was all about, we're all in this together. But over the course of 15 months, we really do see that while we are experiencing this, you know, global crisis together, we're all experiencing it so differently, you know. One particular about my family is that we have a family member who's very high risk for COVID, so and not a child, so there's no vaccine yet for children. So while
under
many
12.
Families, under 12, yes, child under 12. So while many families are, you know, the adults are vaccinated and so they're going on vacations and they're having play dates and they're getting together, we are not there yet, you know. We're still trying to navigate how do we interact with other people now, still with our children unvaccinated and one such, you know, at such a high risk for COVID. So I think it's just, again, super interesting how we're all experiencing this so differently and how important it is to get out of your own perspective for a minute, pick your head up and look around and see that, yeah, we're all really experiencing this on different levels and different intensities.
So Beth Tytel, I'm going to turn back to you in a minute, but I want to get a couple more voices here. One is from Twitter, at Liz McCarthy, who told us, I've stopped taking things for granted. We lost both my father-in-law and my dad, not from COVID, during pandemic and weren't able to hold or attend funerals for either. Attending kids' sports events, used to hate it, I'm a bad mom, crossing state lines at will. That was at Liz McCarthy. And I'm sorry for your losses, Liz. And I want to add another voice here. Caller 1-800-423-8255. We've got Denise in Watertown. Denise, go ahead.
Hello?
Hi, Denise, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm very excited to be on air for the first time, and I'm a supporter of your station. I want to say that I agree with all the callers. Everybody's been very different through COVID. I'm vaccinated. I'm an extrovert. I get out almost every day during COVID. I don't have children, so I guess I'm lucky there. But I was a social worker, and I understand that women with children without a significant other in the house were definitely stressed out, and my hat goes off to them. However, back to my experience, I was able to go out to nature every day, walk around the Charles River with my husband. My relationship was good with my husband, but it got even tighter. And I was able to see the winter for the first time and its colors and the blue-green ice on the ponds over at Mount Auburn Cemetery. I looked at the trees differently, the gray and the brown. I just saw the whole winter and on a whole different level. And
let me take it back from you there, Denise. Denise, thank you. Thank you for the call and thank you for the support. Beth, Tytel, I want to come to you. What strikes me in hearing Denise, and there was something really bucolic, really joyous about what she was saying, but also some of the pain and loss that we heard from Liz McCarthy over Twitter. This is a moment where joy intersects with pain.
Yes. I think I interviewed people, a lot of people I talked to were having what they described as existential crises. And because of the pain, they took a look at how they were living and thought death seemed very present to everybody. Perhaps they had lost somebody or just afraid of their own life for their own lives. They, a lot of people took a look at how they were living and saying, is like, this is it. Is this what I want my life to be? And hearing her to describe the winter made me think about people I talked to who just decided to slow down. Like they had just been self-described type A people. And then during the pandemic, they actually started enjoying nature and spending time with family members without constantly feeling like, well, I've got to leave in 10 minutes or I need to get, you know, to do this. So I think it has been such an intense time for people. At the same time, I think people are still people. Like I've interviewed so many people who were talking to me during the pandemic about missing their families. And last summer they couldn't go on the family reunion. And this summer they're on the family reunion. And now they're complaining to me about their family members. So I think that some things do change, but some things actually never change.
So Bethany, I heard you chuckle there.
Because we forget so quickly, don't we? One of my favorite things about New England is everyone complaining in the winter about the cold and then everybody complaining about the heat in the summer and not remembering how badly you were waiting for summer while it was winter. And I kind of feel the same about this pandemic, and I really am being very intentional and very conscious of that. And while, you know, in this past 15 months, when it was overwhelming to just be on top of each other, there's four of us in our household, just when it got overwhelming to just take a minute to think about what a rare opportunity this has been to be together, to watch the kids grow, to be right there for every little thing, and how much I'm actually going to miss it when they're back at school and we're back working out of the house, how I will look back on these times and really miss it. So trying to enjoy it as much as possible while it's going on and while I want to yell, go upstairs, but really just being so, like, being very grateful that we have this time together.
All right, that is Bethany Van Delft, host of The 10 News and Artisanal Comedy and co-host of Parental Logic on Nova PBS, and Beth Tytel, a features reporter with the Boston Globe. So glad you could both join us for the conversation. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right, folks, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. So glad you listened and called and joined us. Do it again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.